Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. It's Sunday, the 17th of May. I'm Phil Carroll.
I'm Kevin Hornsby.
And what have you been up to this week?
Not much, really, to be honest. Just no. Working. Been to the beach once. Got too much wax in my ear, so got a sore ear. Other than that, I'm all good.
You're all good. So have you had any volcanic eruptions or anything like that? Any exciting things happening?
Yeah,
on
the volcano. The volcano started erupting again on Thursday, our time. So, yeah, if you go onto YouTube, you can see it live erupting, actually. So, yeah, but I'm not sure I'm driving 2.5 hours each way just to see it again. So,
Is it how long it takes to get around the island? I imagine it quite small, but is it literally like the slow roads, a bit like being on Guernsey or Jersey or something like that?
Yeah, not very quick roads, let's put it that way. If you go onto YouTube and go to Kilauea Volcano Hawaii, which is Kilauea Volcano Hawaii, then you can see the live pictures of it. It has now stopped erupting again and now just farting a lot of steam out of its doodah. But yeah. Yesterday it was going great guns.
Yeah, it's very, very active, isn't it? It's very active. I remember that. Okay, well, let's have a look at some of the news stories that have dominated the headlines this week. Middle East oil crisis. The biggest global story remains tensions around Iran and the Strait of Hormuz. Oil markets remain volatile as traders fear shipping disruption through one of the world's most critical energy routes. Diplomatic talks are continuing, but military tensions remain high. There was an update, actually, late Friday that came through related to that, with saying certainly related to Israel and Lebanon, actually, that they agree into a 45-day extension of ceasefire, the US has said. So that's interesting. But what do you make of that? Obviously, you know, oil markets massively volatile. Gold really had a sell-off, didn't it, on late Thursday into Friday. The RSI was like 19. I think it was one of the most oversold that it's been in a long time. So, yeah, oil and gold.
Gold and silver both got sold off badly, didn't they? The oil, I mean, it comes to one of our guests today, Paul, from Buccaneer Energy. You know, they're printing cash at the minute. And even that he was explaining the forward end of the curve, and it's stretching out and out and out now because these issues are not going to be resolved immediately. I mean, they open the Strait of Hormuz today and wave everybody through. I still think you're talking about 6 to 12 months just to get everybody back. And there's going to be a few shocks then as well, because people are going to think, you know, the oil's just going to start flowing, and it isn't, because there's going to be issues. And that's if it all starts today. So, the gold and the silver, I'm not worried about them at all, because I can't see that the central banks are going to start changing their policies to start hoarding gold instead of US dollars. It's going to happen. So I think by the end of the year, we'll have a record high on both gold and silver. And, you know, all I'd say is accumulate or accumulate miners that have got silver, gold, copper, because they haven't had any uplift whatsoever, from what I can see, for all of these things.
Yeah, I agree. Did you see the bizarre news from Iran? They're saying that they're threatening the tariff on undersea internet cables now. I mean, it's like it's getting ridiculous. I mean, this is one of the later. This is on day 77 as we enter this this conflict. Yeah, so quite what they're playing at there, I'm not sure, but that's one of their tariffs. Maybe it's a response to Trump's crazy tariffs on the shipping lanes. Then we saw obviously Trump visiting Beijing, didn't we? Trump and Xi Jinping met in Beijing this week in a major geopolitical summit focused on trade, Iran, Taiwan, and global security. China is positioning itself as an equal superpower to the US, while tensions over Taiwan remain unresolved. So, yeah, interesting. What do you make of Trump and Xi Jinping and their relationship now, Kev?
Well, it's good, I think, for geopolitics in general. I mean, it was quite the scene, wasn't it? You saw all the biggest companies in the world basically going to China to say, hello, how are you? Let's do business together. because they want the business, obviously. They want to do business rather than. And I think when it all comes down to it, China needs the US and the US needs China. So if they fight, they both lose. If they don't fight and they can have a more amicable situation, then they both win. Will that happen? Doubt it. China's playing a long game and the US wants a short-term fix. So that's my view.
Yeah, absolutely. And then obviously a bit closer to home, UK politics, Labour turmoil continues after poor election performances. We saw Wes Streeting, the health secretary, resign amid growing internal pressure on Keir Starmer, while Andy Burnham is preparing a Westminster return bid. Reform UK continues gaining momentum nationally. So what do you make of that? We saw Andy Burnham resign as MP, so he's really is preparing himself for this Westminster return. And I think we're going to see the likes of Wes Streeting and Burnham going for PM, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, Starmer's dead man walking, surely. You know, I mean, half of his party doesn't want him there, or a good proportion of his party doesn't want him there. They don't want to rock the boat right now because it would be disastrous. Will Andy Burnham even get into Parliament is the question, because now Reform are going to throw everything at that other by-election. In where is it? It's just outside Wigan, isn't it? So yeah, it's going to be interesting. But the whole thing's a mess. Doesn't matter
It
who's
is,
in charge. It's a mess.
yeah. There's
Sorry.
not one person, is there, or one party or one candidate that you think to yourself, this is leader. They are leadership material. It's woeful, isn't it? British politics is absolutely pitiful, woeful. It's an excuse, and yeah. Okay, well, we've got an action-packed show, so I'm going to let do the rightful thing and let you introduce the guest, Kev, this week.
Welcome, Paul Welsh, Buccaneer Energy. How's things going, Paul, there over in America?
Things are going great. Thanks for asking. Things are really going well from the last time we spoke. Primarily to do with field operations and the oil price, so everything is kind of coming together very nicely.
Yeah, it's not for reasons that we enjoy, but at the end of the day, your $100 plus oil right now, how's that looking in terms of the cash flow position from, trading at $55, $60 a barrel?
Looking fantastic. So last month we made over 200,000 bucks in free cash flow. This month we're looking probably closer to 270, right? Just in cash we're going to generate from our current operations. Our operations were supplemented, as you know, as we did a transaction. We bought the Carlisle One well. The Carlisle One well this month is going to generate 70,000 bucks in cash, and we only paid $425,000 for it. So it was a fantastic opportunity for us, and so. That cash, allows us some choices, and those choices are to reinvest in business and continue to grow. And we've got a couple projects in the field that we can go do that, with our internal funds, which we're very excited about.
Very good. So, I mean, at even $200,000 a month free cash flow, $2.4 million a year, that's going to allow you to internally grow very quickly. But what do we see in terms of barrels of oil between now and sort of the next few months, even without an accretive deal?
So again, not looking at any deals, just what we see in the field at the moment is we have two things. First, we have the Fowle Carey water flood. So that process has kicked off. Because we bought the Carlisle One well, we now have more than 50% of that project. So we're taking the project lead and we're going to become the operator. So that means that we can start moving that project forward, which we're doing, right? That will add another 50 to 60 barrels, well, 50 to 80 barrels a day gross, of which we'd get half. Right. So we're looking at another 25 to 40 barrels a day from that. And again, these are the most profitable barrels that we have in the field. The OPEX down there is $5 a barrel. So, so at $100
Wow.
oil, which is what we have now, we're making $95 in free cash flow per barrel that we produce. So that's fantastic. So that's opportunity one. Opportunity two is something we've talked about before, which is the OOR project. So we started the OOR project up in the northern part of the field. We pumped it in the ground. We doubled production in the area. Production has come off a little bit because we have stopped injecting so much water. And so, what happened with the OR project is that when we put it in the ground, we saw an immediate increase in production, an immediate decrease in oil production, an immediate decrease in water production. So now we're making the same amount of oil, but we're producing 1,200 barrels a day less of fluid. Okay. And for us, that's a big deal because, we have two big expenses in the field. One is staff and the other is power. And power is directly driven by the amount of fluids that we move. And so having dropped off, 1200 bucks, 1200 barrels a day of fluid means our margins increase. So that OR project has what way we describe it has improved the efficiency of our water flood. We're looking now to expand that to the rest of the field. And so that will add, we expect another 45 barrels a day. And just so, put it in perspective, a treatment costs us $65,000, right? So it's less than a workover. It's fantastic. So, and we're only treating the injection wells. We don't have to treat the producers anymore. So we don't have any downtime associated with it. So again, this is another project that we're really excited about because we think we can, find some barrels in the field, improve the efficiency of the water flood when we couldn't do that in the past. So we're really, really pretty excited about that. So those are the two projects that I see coming in. So at the moment we're making, around 150 barrels a day gross across all assets. With these two projects, we think we can get up to 200 to 250 barrels a day just through internal growth. No outside capital required. And then, once we hit that level, then we're really starting generating some serious cash, right? Or generating really serious cash now. But at that point, it'll be, well, clearly double where we are at the moment.
Yeah, well, even if we get a resolution to this Strait of Hormuz thing and war and oil drops back to $70, $80 a barrel, which is probably quite likely because we've seen that happen already. If you move up to 250, 225, 250 barrels a day, then I presume that free cash flow is still going to be 200, $250,000
Oh, easy. For sure.
a month. So you're talking about $2.5 to $3 million of free cash flow to pump back into the system. And just explain to people how these deals can be done, because how much does the company have to pay for a new deal, and how much can you borrow from the bank to make these deals work?
Okay, it's just so it's clear to your listeners, the two deals that we just talked about there, the two transact things we're talking about too, don't require any outside capital, right? So the Falcon Water flood and the OR project expansion. Again, that's internal cash, no outside capital required. That's what get us, first 250 and then grow. Beyond that, if we want to grow, we have a very supportive lending bank, which is called WaFd. So any deal that we do would require anywhere between 40 and 50% capital from our side, and then the remainder coming from the bank. And the bank is really enthusiastic about our growth. We're an onshore Texas story. We make good cash flow. We've been a good customer of the banks for a long time. So they are encouraging us to go out and look for new opportunities. Again, we're going to do that, but we need to get what we describe as the maximum amount of cash flow we can. I don't think people appreciate that. We've got ourselves a very, very profitable base business. And from that base, we generate cash. And with that cash in hand, that gives us opportunities. And those opportunities allow us to create value. And that's what we're really focused on, is taking that cash and generating opportunities. The last transaction we did, we bought the Carlyle well, and that really has, moved the needle for us in two ways. Strategically, it gives us 50% of the FAP water flood. And then secondarily, it's throwing off, $70,000 a month of cash. We only paid 425 for it, so it's going to pay out in under 6 months. And those 6 months started in January, right? So I mean, we bought it at an effective date of 1/1, 2026. So we're well ahead of our anticipated payout for that opportunity. So a
So
lot has changed since our last discussion, in a very good way.
at this level with free cash flow of basically your market cap per annum, 1.5 million with free cash flow of probably in excess of that 1.5 million. Do you feel that it's wise that you actually protect shareholder value at this level by, I mean, raising at
Definitely,
this point would be crazy.
No, we can't. I mean, we have no plans to do that in any way, shape, or form. We need to grow the share price. Our view is that that gap will close. So, to put it in perspective, we're generating about, our market cap, 10% of our market cap per month in free cash, right? And so, from our perspective, that gap between our NPV value, which is over $10 million, and our current share price will naturally close when we consistently deliver free cash flow to the business. And so that's been our focus, and that's what we intend to do. So again, we view that as something that's incredibly important. generating a consistent story, a consistent set of cash flow. So the market is going to be convinced that yes, this is going to happen. And so that will naturally close. That's our view. And so everything we do, we're just focused on generating cash. So, there are deals out there to be done. Yeah, they're there. But we have to get to space. We have to get to 250, and then from 250, we'll have a sufficient amount of cash flow that anything we would do would be accretive. But again, the focus now, cash, generating cash, and generating cash consistently, and whether that's $100 or $80, wherever the oil price drops to when this problem is settled, we're still going to be in a very positive cash flow generating mode.
Yeah, I think it's going to drag on longer than we all think, which obviously for you from a cash flow position will benefit you. And also even when it does get resolved, I think there might be a relief drop, but then the realization that the oil isn't actually there for a period of time is also going to bump it back up again. Maybe not to 100, but we will see.
So if you look at the back end of the forward curve, before, when originally had the problem occurred, we spiked up over 100, but then by the end of the year, we were back down to 65, 70, by say December of 2026. Now, if you look at that curve, it's much broader. So the back end of the curve has us between 80 and $85 a barrel. So I think everybody kind of agrees with what you just said, that it'll take a lot more time to resolve the current situation, even if we open up the Strait of Hormuz today. So I think high prices are here for a lot longer than people originally expected.
Yeah, and that is just going to mean that you are basically an ATM machine producing a lot of cash, and then if you can turn that cash into more barrels per day, then obviously then the machine just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. So, yeah, listen, Paul, we'll speak to you soon. I mean, I think what the market really needs is for you to keep us up to date with exactly what cash flow you've got coming in each month, so that people can see the visibility of what's actually happening and the money in the bank. And then I think it won't be too soon before your share price starts to move up.
Yeah, well, I look forward to that. So I know we have a lot of patient shareholders, and I appreciate their patience. But I think we're to the point now where I think the reward is just around the corner. We are in a good position to generate, I'd say, above market shareholder returns because we're generating such a solid amount of cash, and the market cap is so low. I mean, again, we're generating 10% of our market cap per month. It's crazy low, but let's see how it goes.
Yeah, well, crazy low share prices get crazy good returns in the end. So let's see what
That's
happens.
right. Now's the time, people. Now is the time.
Yes, indeed. I think it is. I think it is. And I think you're right. Okay, good to speak to you again, Paul. And look forward to speaking to you in the not too distant future.
Okay. Thanks again for your time. Appreciate it.
So we're welcoming our main guest today, who's Mr. Colin Bird, Chairman of Kendrick Resources. How are we today, Colin?
We're fine. Thank you very much indeed. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. Obviously, I'm talking to you from Hawaii. Whereabouts in the world are you?
Spain, in Spain at the moment.
Okay, very good. Very good. Now, the scenario is today we've had an announcement, as in today is Friday. We've had an announcement from Kendrick basically showing us results of a 112-meter drill hole. Do you want to explain how that affects the project and what it confirms?
Well, what it confirms is that grade keeps coming up time in, time out, the sort of three and a half type grade. I think what's the significance is 112 meters. That's significant. That's no mean interception. And as you know, and within that there's 17 meters at over 4%. So what are we saying really? That we drilled another one of the plugs, call them ice cream cones, call them outcrops, call them mountains, call them what you like. But the ones we drill, and this is another one from the first one, consistency, consistency, and that's what we, miners like really, consistency. Not about your highest result, although some of them are pretty impressive. But if you can maintain grades of 3.5% with the light magnetics being predominant, 25% of your value, then you're onto a very, very good project. So I guess what we've done, what have we achieved really in the last couple of weeks? We've put together tons, because that's always a big question. Always a big question in rare earths. If you've got tons, you haven't got grade. If you've got grade, you haven't got tons. But this project is shaping up to have both. And our best reference point, of course, is Mountain Pass. And if you look at Mountain Pass, they've got 18 million tons. We've identified quite scientifically, that's not a, you know, it's not a thumb suck, already 14 million tons. We know it goes below ground. And we haven't even touched, yet. So that's not even touched. And we haven't gone below surface level with Tortoise Coupe. So when you think about it, this could only grow in tonnage tremendously. Wild card, not particularly wild card, it stands alone on the Tortoise Coupe. It stands alone. But when we get down to the other project, what we're seeing is that I don't think it's been looked at scientifically. And, you know, our boys, we have got a nice mix of science and a very nice mix of very practical geologists. And it would appear that the top level has been eroded and we're into level two down there. And so we're probably looking at a big flat sheet of similar type material. The grade we don't know, but we've got a good, you know, it looks as though it's going to be well over 2.5, possibly over 3. So we're looking at collectively, I think, you know, we've made these protestations or we've suggested before, but I think we are looking at a world-class project without any doubt whatsoever. The more we see, the more we like it. And you know what mining projects are. It often goes very much the other way. The more you see, the less you like it. So it's growing both in terms of size and in terms of grade. We're not looking for growth. We're looking for consistency. And that's what we're getting. Long runs of the very, very similar grades as we go from plug to plug. And we're seeing consistent grades. And our channel sampling is telling us that as well. And just as soon as we've collated it all, we'll be releasing that. So there's a nice word there is consistency. And I think when you're talking rare earths, nice word there is tons. Tons and tons, consistency of grade, superior grades, equivalent to Mountain Pass. And probably a lot more of it. So we're very, very, very pleased with that project, the way it's shaping up.
Yeah, and I mean, the hole tells us that, you know, the 14 million tons is obviously not what we're going to be stopping at in terms of a resource base. Even the first hole as well, I presume, is not included in that 14 million tons on surface resource statement.
It's not a resource statement. That's basically a tonnage statement, and that was done by drones and surveying. So really, you're looking at those 9 plugs which are sticking out, and they're sticking out very high. Some of them. That's the surface expression. Obviously, if you look at them as inverted ice cream cones, if you like, then below surface is more and more. So I use the word in the chairman's comment: the tip of the iceberg. And that's exactly what we're looking at here, the tip of the iceberg. So I don't know what it will go to 28, what it'll go to, but we're already getting very close to Mountain Pass. And we've got another project to look at. That's to be looked at, both in terms of grade and tons. And Teufel's copy, as I say, that's where you've got your results, because that's where you've got the surface expression. Then there's your 14 million tons. So really what you've got is a very, very large area, and we don't even know what's below surface. And I stressed again, and I'll stress it yet again, we're not even talking about open pit mining. You were talking about quarrying, where you just in actual fact blast the stuff away and cart it away. You're talking about very, very, very low mining costs. And it's quite a unique, remarkable project.
Yeah, no, it is. And I mean, if you haven't read Charles Archer's article, then I suggest you do, when he gives a comparison to some of the biggest projects in the world. And potentially we are comparable with those. And there's two of them there that have valuations of in excess of $10 billion in the US. So, I mean, this is, I think, much bigger than everybody really understands, mainly because it's come from little old Kendrick, and little old Kendrick, has found, an asset that is basically unbelievable in terms of the small AIM market. But I think that's going to change over time as you move through the process. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, I have to confess, it's taken us a bit by surprise. We knew it was big. I mean, the big win really was we wasn't starting from a concept. There they stuck the big carbonatites. They were sticking out of the ground. They've been known for some time. a lot more work had been done on them than we thought, but generally by government scientific missions and what have you. So really not much commercial direction towards them. And neither were rare earths. If you go back 20, 30 years, who cared very much about rare earths? Nobody. And they only got sort of excited about them in 2010. Senate committees, all sorts of bodies formed to make sure the West got access to rare earths. And that initiative went to sleep, you know, and went absolutely to sleep. And now it's really as opened up as the world has begun to polarize. So what do we think? We're delighted, Kevin. We're absolutely delighted. I mean, if I can turn the clock back only two months, I knew I was onto a good project when we decided with our partner to partner up with our partner on other projects in Namibia. But I, you know, I'll just be absolutely straight up and honest with you. I had no idea of either the magnitude, the quality, or the consistency of this project. It, I think our opening statements a few weeks ago, we were talking about it being among the top three undeveloped rare earth projects in the world. I'm now being bold enough to suggest that it might be one of the best, if not the best project, which has probably ever been discovered. And discovery is not the appropriate words. It's been known about for a long time, but it's probably one of the big, if not the biggest project which has ever been put together. And we're in the process of putting it together just as fast as we can. And the good news is that these weathered carbonatites, they've got voids and holes in them. And so when you're drilling, bang, all of a sudden you're in fresh air inside the mountain there. And so we're employed now. We're going to bring in reverse circulation. We're approaching them almost like kimberlites. And with kimberlites, you drill them. But if you're drilling for diamonds, you'll not find a diamond, or it'll be just very, very lucky. So what you do, you go for population size, statistics. And we're doing the same. We're bringing in reverse circulation. We're going to get a big population size. That's less important in grade determination than it is in metallurgical test work. You need, as you drill, to be building up a composite sample, which is a representation of all the holes, so that when you do your met test work, you've actually got a very, very representative sample. But you know, even that, Kevin, we're starting at grassroots. We've sent the samples off to the United States. And they're in a university lab where that equipment doesn't exist very much. There's not much of that type of equipment around the world. And so we will start right from grassroots with our mineralogy, with the way the ore body presents itself, the rare earth elements, proximity to one another. These things are all, you know, very, very closely grouped in the periodic table. And so we're basically starting as though the project is a concept in terms of our metallurgical approach. Because it's one thing finding an ore body, lots of tons, lots of nice grades. It's another thing treating it, and we're making sure that we start from the right base. So we're not going to start, you know, get a big sample and start seeing if we can leach it. What's it like on ion exchange? What's it like on mag set? How do you depress the thorium? Do you need to depress the thorium? How does the thorium occur relative to the rare earths? How do the rare earths occur relative to one another? We're actually getting a very good statement of the mineralogy. And I think it's certainly not small company work, but we're not going from A to D. We're going through all the steps. And I'm confident, and we're only sort of weeks away from getting that result, a couple of weeks away from getting that result. Then the metallurgical consultants will come in. That will have to be a company thing. It's not an individual thing. And we'll start evaluating what is the best process route, what's the best product to produce. But you know, and I'll ask you a question. You know, you just basically do a bit of geography. Deep water 60 kilometers away, power line through the project, roads. You know, if you couldn't have parked a project of this quality anywhere better in the world, as you wanted. So, you know, the bigger, much bigger companies than us, even with our sort of ambition to grow this into a large company very quickly, but bigger companies than us will hopefully be considering building and this might be a government-to-government, who knows, building a refinery at Ludovitz. That's the obvious thing to do. Because to build a refinery at Ludovitz, when you, in actual fact, with the Bonya project, our project, probably got 60% of the feed. You can receive other feeds from Southern Africa and elsewhere, and yet have a refinery which is well positioned within 60 kilometers, to be the base feed to justify the capital investment, because this, you know, it's no mean capital investment to build a rare earth refinery. So, you know, when you think about it, as I say, step back 3 months, well, we saw a project we liked, we saw a project what we thought had got fundamentals. It's very quickly turning into something very, very, very serious and drawing the attention of lots of companies and countries, for that matter, in the world. This is a very interesting project. It stands out, it stands alone, and I'm sure it's on a lot more radars than I know about, even. So, yes.
Yeah, this project was owned by the same guys that gave you which other project, or that, well, you partnered?
They basically are the project from Ongombo, the Zaki project from Ongombo, which is the gold copper gold project near Windhoek. And okay. The gentleman concerned is a prominent businessman in the country and good to work with, and is well known in country and well respected in country.
Good. Okay. I mean, regarding Kendrick, obviously we're looking for more and more results. And as you've said, there's going to be metallurgical work going on. Within a few months, I think you'll almost certainly have a jork of the initial 14 million tons for sure, and other stuff. You know, other than that, what can we expect is going to happen in Kendrick in the next few weeks?
Well, Kendrick in the next few weeks, because you've got this surface expression, there'll be channel sampling, and they'll be putting the three-dimensional with trenches. We will be going down to Kaisali and having a preliminary reconnaissance. We've got some nice trenches down there, so we'll be sampling those. We'll be cleaning up samples. We've actually found two boreholes, which have never been even assayed down that part of the concessions. So they will be assayed too. So, you know, we start off with a mountain of a, well, that's the wrong word. We start off with a lot of core trenches and that have never been previously assayed. So we're busily assaying them too. Then, of course, we split and cut our assays and sent them off to be assayed in an independent lab. Those results have got to come back. As we drill and get more sort of third dimension to this, we build up the ore body. And I don't think our maiden resource will be 40 million tons, Kevin, because we will have gone below the plugs. And so I expect to come with a maiden resource well in excess of that. And it's all happening together. So I don't think we're going to be short of news. What am I looking for? Cutting aside that part of what we do as a business, and what we have to do as a business, keep our shareholders informed, keep the market informed, keep the trade informed. What I'm personally looking for is very, very simple. Very, very simple. More of the same. Been in this situation before. Fortunately, we haven't got to make the market happy with increased grades. That's the very, very impressive grade. So if I keep getting more and more of it, I'm not looking for an higher grade. And I won't be too disappointed if there's 0.5% off here and there. The grade is so superior that it can withstand a little bit of a grade drop-off. Tonnage, I'm convinced we can build the tonnage up. So really all I'm looking for is, as fast as we can, in the most professional way we can, is to do much of the same and keep the market informed. Because I think we've got a market that understands we're on to quite a special project. I think we've got a market who gets encouraged by every single news release we make, and you've got a management team fully aligned with the market, been around long enough to know what the market expects and what the trading expects as well, Kevin, what the trade expects. We've got to make it our business to know that anybody who's remotely interested in rare earths know about this project. It's quite amusing, really. We keep getting, I won't say from when we're from, but we keep getting requests for, can we sell the X tons of rare earths? And that is a bit premature. That is a bit premature. But it does show from the places you'd never even dream of. So it does show that our project is reaching out to all over the globe. And why shouldn't it, with the results we're getting?
Yeah. But these magnet rare earths are totally controlled by the Chinese. And this will open up the world's market to the rest of the world. And I presume that is your intention, that this is going to be Europe, US, Western Hemisphere bound and not Chinese.
Yeah, yes. You know, that I think that basically almost goes without saying. And as I say, the position is absolutely magnificent. Potential for a refinery is great because refinery capacity is confined as well to Asia, you know, China. So you do need refinery capacity around the world. So that's why I'm extending all the time when I talk to the people what really matter. You know, it's not big checkbooks as much. The real big end of the industry. The main selling part for our project is that it's positioned close to the coast and able to supply a refinery. And if you've got plans to build a well-placed refinery, why not build it at Ludovitz? Because 60 kilometers away, there's a resource which you'll keep your full for the, you know, 60% of your plant full while you receive other rare earth oxides from around the world. So yes, we're going to be this project looks like it's going to be the answer, part of the answer to the Western demand, strategically placed rare earth deposits with refinery capacity. And as I say, there's a stack of boxes ticked with that statement, but management very firmly believe that is the case.
And from a Namibian point of view, you know, this could provide serious number of jobs in an area that would be well welcomed. And they also have a lot of experience in the mining sector as well in this part of the world.
That's absolutely correct. You've got a very, very progressive government. You've got a cabinet which was well directed to developing the minerals industry. Offshore, onshore, oil, gas, copper, uranium. That country is extremely well positioned, and it is extremely businesslike in its approach. It's a good place to work. It's an understanding place to work. It's not a difficult place to work in as much as government are aligned with the objectives. Be one of the Southern African countries which are blessed and have got a good mineral distribution. And want to make the best of those minerals, as you say, to create jobs and to further the ambitions of the nation. And this is yet another addition to the uranium and to the gas and oil and all of the other things which are being discovered which have been gone on for some considerable time. The uranium, as copper, but lots of new ventures happening and lots of Western involvement in the country. And so, you know, if you want to tick the next box, we've ticked quite a few boxes in this discussion. If you look at jurisdiction, it stands out. It's a very, 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 very good jurisdiction in which to work. You know how you stand. You surely know how you stand, what's expected of you. And provided you get your head down, get on with the work, there's a place for foreign investment in Namibia, that's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's almost look at this as a Namibian special. And let's move on to Bazant Resources. I mean, you're going to have a fully functioning mine processing plant for copper and gold concentrate within the next few months. So just tell everybody about Bazant and, you know, what's happened.
Well, that's going well. All the orders are placed. I think everybody knows that. We're working on the road. That's quite an intent. That's the most intensive activity at the moment because of the camp, for example, has been manufactured in Swakopmund. So you've got to take it into the desert, and deserts can have bumpy gravel roads and a long low bed might get sort of perched on a hump in the road. So we're spending our money, a lot of money on leveling the roads so that we can actually get all the equipment to site. As I say, it's been manufactured in Swakopmund, paid deposits for the screening and for the ore sorting plant. So they're being manufactured. They will be delivered to site in about a month and a half. We're already working intensely on the NLZM plant, and that's been a pleasant surprise, Kevin. You know, you would expect a plant which had been on care and maintenance 5 or 6 years for the conveyor belts to be all brittle and not worth, you know, really not usable. You would expect the rollers to be all rusty and not turn. You would expect the motors for the various parts of the plant to be powered up, if you like. You would expect the various pumps not to work. But in actual fact, the ratio of pumps that do work and nearly work, motors that do work and nearly work, very, very high compared to what we expected. So we're more likely well, not more likely, we're in the middle of doing it, to send these pumps and motors down to Swakopmund to be sort of cleaned up as opposed to be replaced, repurchased, and, you know, to purchase new ones. So that's a win. That's a win on the money side. And that's in progress. We've identified and got the cone crusher. So that's been got up to site. So everything going along there. We've talked about bringing in the and doing the first earth moving around about the beginning of July. We certainly don't need to get too far ahead of the game there, because it's not as though you've got a big pre-strip. We haven't got a big pre-strip. Those sulfides are reporting to surface. We're doing what you'd expect us to do, Kevin. We've identified the place that we actually put in the ramp to access the ore resource to be high grade, so that we kick off with an high grade start. We're not going to put very, very high grade material through for the first few weeks whilst you're running up a plant, because that's also a silly thing to do. So you want to optimize the plant, and then we hope that we can high grade the place. So everything's in place and running. And as you know, the bulletin boards are full of where's the finance, where's the finance, where's the finance. Well, we're working with a top-level financing company, and they've got protocols, and we're not the largest deal by any means they've ever done. I was going to make the expression, we're probably one of the smallest deals, so I don't want to overstate, but I think we are on the smaller side of the deal size for them. And they are not going to change their protocols, their due diligence, the way they work relative to the size of the deal. Because if you want to get things wrong in life, that's the way to do it. Oh, this is only a small deal. We'll skip this. We'll skip that. They don't do it. Professional companies don't do that. So I'm pretty sure I can say with absolute confidence that we're in the final stages of completing that financing. I know the market is frustrated, totally frustrated with us for that. Every negotiation has got two sides of the table. I'm one side of the table. The pen and the checkbook is the other side of the table, and they need satisfying, Kevin. And if anybody thinks that's bad, then they're not living on the planet that I'm living. I do understand the need for due diligence. I understand that other people have got their jobs to protect and have got to stick to company protocol. So the financing will be announced. I'm confident at the moment. But I look at this thing on a weekly basis. I wish that were true. I look at it on a daily basis. When you're building a plant, it's nerve-wracking. And you're always looking for a problem. We don't seem to have any major problems on the horizon. All the equipment, I think, will be delivered within the time that we require it. We've got essential members of the team recruited already. And I was out there 2 weeks ago. Very impressed. They've made some very, very good recruitments. Guys who will be a pleasure to work with. And all locally recruited, not imported, which is very, very good. These guys have held senior jobs at operations within Namibia. So that's good. And of course, there was a residual workforce. Not a residual, that's probably the wrong word. There was a workforce from NLZM who basically lost their jobs when the plant closed down, available for recruitment. So that's good. We've also got a we've got a pool of labour who know their NLZM plant and won't be new to them. And so they will be able to step in, some of them, into their old jobs. So that's good. So quite frankly, put a big ring around that with the few statements I made. And again, on budget in terms of build and on budget in terms of cost. And we're confident the financing is around the corner.
Very good. From the point of view of a few people, obviously not very happy that you had to raise and raise with warrants before this finance came through, what say you?
That's a good question. What do I say? I don't want to stutter. I mean, basically, I've got a fiduciary duty to keep this company in funds. I've got a personal duty and a personal pledge to the shareholders. I'm going to get it running before the year end, and I'll be producing concentrate, hopefully, by August, September. If I see a situation where I've got absolute momentum and part of the financing is not yet achieved, do I sit down and bite my fingernails and wait? Lose all credibility with the suppliers, lose all credibility with the contractors, lose all credibility with the government, lose all credibility with the surrounding community. Or do I do what's necessary and keep the project at maximum momentum? And that choice was not difficult. I decided my fiduciary duty, my commitment to the project, my commitment to the government, and the shareholders will see in the course of time, my commitment to the shareholders was satisfied by making that placement. And, you know, I have to justify it, but I can't regret it. Whichever way I look at it, I can't regret it. Because when you're in that situation, you have to make a decision. You make that decision, and I did it. And if I was in the same place, I'd do it again, Kevin. Because to be now momentum, when I've got a project, which basically at 14,000 ton copper is hitting 4 million, 40 million a year income, surplus income over expenditure, why would I hold that up for the fact that suffer more dilution than we want? But the sort of numbers I'm talking, the dilution will be peanuts when we actually look at a project who's generating that sort of money. If you look at a multiple of 4 or 5 times cash flow in value, when you're looking at 150 to 200 million pound company, you have to do what you have to do. And sadly, yeah. Okay, and you know what, Kevin, in this small mine sector, I know we receive a lot of criticism, we CEOs and chairmen, because we sometimes make decisions which, if you're sat remote, sound a bit daft. Why on earth did he do that? Why on earth did he do this? But, you know, you've got a set of circumstances, and when you've got a deck of cards, and you've got to play them, Kevin. You've got to play them. And quite frankly, I wasn't at the time I made that decision, there weren't many aces flying around. So the project was going along nicely, and I ensured that the project continued to go along nicely. So that's my answer, long-winded. If I sound defensive, I would sooner not have had to do that placement. But with all the facts which were facing me, position we were in, we did that placement, and of course we'd do it again if we had to, because the project, once it's up and running, again puts Byzant in a new place in the AIM market.
Yeah, I think I'd like you to explain the potential extension to Byzant, because I think people are only looking short term, this open pit, which is Hope itself, and then Gorup. But what is the longer term view for this whole area?
Well, there you go. You understand this very well, that you really are scratching the surface with this first mine. We've got 17 kilometers between Hope and Gorup. And they're just two little mountains, Hope and Gorup. And this first mine, really, Hope, will keep it going for 10 to 12 years, well beyond any debt period. And we've got outcrops over the 17 kilometres. We've got various areas where holes have been stuck in by past drillers in the 70s, by the past South African mining companies. So the potential, here I go again, but the potential for a really big project, I wouldn't say it exists. It's extremely likely. It's extremely likely. Because, you know, Kevin, we're not talking about concepts again. There's 69,000 meters of drilling there at Byzant. We're not even bothered about that with this little operation. That drilling started at 150 meters. Why did it start at 150 meters? Because the powers that be at that time didn't want to surface dig, because you couldn't handle oxides, and they were convinced there would be oxides. They were wrong. They're not oxides. The sulfides all the way to surface. So if you can envisage 17 kilometers, not all live, that would be too ambitious. But certainly a good portion of it live, over 17 kilometers, not drilled between surface and 150 meters. You've actually got a running open pit. And this is why Martin's always happy. Every time we do some more drilling, we bring in some more open pit reserves, filling the gap between surface of 150. So it's huge. And we'd be very disappointed if we didn't find at least 500,000 tons of contained copper. Now, you know, it's again 20 times, if you look at 25,000 tons of copper times 20 years, that would justify a much bigger plant, to 2.5 million ton a year plant. And that's our ambition for this project, that we build something an whole lot bigger. As soon as we get in surface cash flow, we'll be applying some of that cash flow into drilling and expanding the project into something much bigger and something much more desirable for the mining world, the trade, and ourselves. But I think if copper's scarce now, Kevin, it's going to be a damn sight scarcer in 2 years' time. It's actually, if I look at the new projects, there aren't any.
Yeah, not only that aren't there any, there's some of the bigger ones are failing as well. So, you know, it's a double whammy. I mean, we're sitting here all week. Copper's been 14,500, 14,700 a ton, going up to 660. The news out of China with Trump has pushed things down a bit, but we're still at $14,000 copper. So what do the finances really look like with $14,000 copper and 4.7 plus gold?
Well, I kick the number out. We keep updating our model, but a surplus of income over expenditure, i.e. cash flow, is 40 million plus. It's only a small project, but when you start putting those numbers, it becomes a very big project in financial numbers. And if you remember about this time last year, we were talking about 9,000 copper, we were talking about 2,800 gold, and we're talking about $25 silver. And that's what the original economics were worked on. And as you know, that got us nearly $30 million of free cash flow. So this project is a super duper project, even as it stands. But start looking at a 25,000 ton a year project with similar metal prices. And that is a very, very serious net present value project. As yeah. I say, it's not as though we started from concept level. There's 69,000 meters of drilling. We've got all the holes, all the data, and we're filling in gaps. So it's not going to take forever to basically take us up into that decision point where we say, well, look, we've got 500,000 ton of copper, 25,000 ton a year. That'll last us 20 years. Then we'll be able to justify a plant. That plant is going to cost about $50 million, $60 million. But by then, you will have a 5 or 6 year track record in producing. And so to track the finance in a world where copper is scarce, where you're in the desert, you've managed to prove, you've proved that you can actually mine, you can prove that you meet your objectives. To expand into phase two won't be the journey of 1,000 lashes. Because, again, I used earlier on in this debate, the word boxes ticked. You've ticked quite a few boxes on the way.
Yeah. So moving on to our next Namibian beauty parade is African Pioneer and the Ongombo asset. So we've had silence on this, other than the fact that you've raised a couple of million pounds in the last number of months. Tell us what's going to happen. Obviously, you obviously can't tell us too much because there's not really been any RNSs, but tell us where we're at.
That's right. And I guess in no small way, availability machines. There's a machine on the way to that project on Gombo, but down in the Rura project, we kept one machine back a bit longer. So yes, we're going to be drilling. There's a lot of trade interest around this project, Kevin. Obviously, I can't reveal that, the nature of it, but it's an exciting project. It's 300,000 tons of contained copper. It's an open-ended in all directions. Next door is Ongiama, which probably has got higher value gold and similar value copper. It was badly drilled. They drilled deep for some reason and didn't explore the surface potential. So we do feel it might add to our open cut. Our open cut is about 2 years at the moment. But in a nutshell, if you look at Ongombo and Ongiama as a joint project, they're probably a year behind Open Gorup. And we are looking at opportunities in the area and are well advanced with our negotiations and discussions. So African Pioneer is basically well positioned, close to Windhoek, and I think will be the next company of ours to actually achieve a lot of market attention because of of what it's achieving and what's being done and what can be done. So Ongombo complements Open Gorup. It's at the other end of the Matchless Copper Belt. We have about 90 kilometers of exploration ground, on that Matchless Copper Belt between the companies. And so, as I say, simplistically, just look at it as a similar. It probably will end up being, in terms of contained copper tonnage sold per annum, probably end up slightly bigger than Open Gorup, more in the region of 10 to 12,000 tons. And again, expandable because of opportunities that we're currently looking at. And sort of, we think, tied down in the area. So African Pioneer is not putting out the news in the short term because it's getting all its ducks in a row for the program. And the program, simplistically, is do all the things that we did prior to getting Open Gorup, where it is now, in terms of drilling, resource modeling, turning a resource into a mineable resource, getting the metallurgy finalized, flow sheets for plants. It's doing all of those things, which are not very announceable, I'm afraid, Kevin, but they're all part of the grand scheme in order to build a mine. But rest assured, there's a stack of work going on there. And I would imagine by the second half of this year, we will be telling the market a lot about our plans, what's the project looking like, when it will be brought into production, what sort of mine will it be? Will it be underground? How will we access the underground? And on that subject, we have developed quite a nice, I think, novel system. We intend to work the open cut more or less as a strip down to about 70, 80 metres. And we will exit that strip mine. We'll use that strip mine to access the underground workings. So we won't be spending a lot of money on actually building arterials and big shafts, be they declines, adits. We certainly won't be doing any vertical shafts, but we'll be accessing the strip mine, which is a nice way of doing things. So as soon as we've cleared enough ground that the open cast strip has moved in front, we'll be starting the first faces to go into commence the underground workings. And it's akin to coal mining in a way. We're blessed with quite a favourable gradient. It's quite shallow. So mining methods should be fairly simple. There is a chance that on the eastern side, we will be able to do some mechanised copper mining as well. So, yes, where is it? It's a year behind Open Gurrup. It's a different mine to Open Gurrup. There's not many similarities at all in terms of mineralisation style presentation. But in terms of mineralogy, the treatment, processing, identical. Very clean concentrate, 92-93% recovery for a 28% concentrate. Very, very clean ore, very nice concentrate to be produced from it. Again, with about a 0.3 to 0.4 gold contribution, that sort of project. So open Gurrup about to happen yet again.
Very good. Very good. Okay. I'm going to go on to the last one that we'll talk about now because we're going to run out of time. But extract resources, obviously not in Namibia. We're talking more in Morocco, in the antimony, which I'm pretty excited about from the fact that, you know, we talk about rare earths being valuable. Antimony is one of those things that the world needs and there isn't enough of it. And then we've got Silver King in terms of copper and gold production. So just give us what you can. And when is the market going to be updated on both of those things?
Yeah, well, let's go to Morocco. All those tunnels have been cleaned out. Every time we clean the tunnel out, we find a new one. Every time we move a dam gas, we find something more interesting. And, you know, we have talked in the past, again, almost like the rare earths, that it's more of a quarried opportunity than it is galleries and tunnels. And if we then, if not when, we are plotting those tunnels, then the orientation of the antimony, and they do crisscross quite a bit. But I've got a suspicion, and a very strong one, that in actual fact, Amgas will end up as quite a large quarry. And so the need to, certainly in the central portion, to underground mining might not be there. We may, in actual fact, start a quarry. We're moving at the moment and towards producing an intermediate project, product, and where we're producing between 12 and 20% antimony, and we'll be producing that in the not-too-distant future. We're putting all our plans into place now. When we've actually got the plans completely in place, we'll advise the market the structure and how it will look. So at the moment, it's being formulated. That will be a precursor to a flotation plant. Why are we doing the intermediate? Because whilst we're waiting for permission for the flotation plant, government permissions, we're allowed to do jigs, spirals, tables, and all of those things to produce an updated rare earth project. And let's face it, as you know, in all those tunnels, we've got broken ground and we've got the ability to start production very, very quickly. Silver King is on the fourth blast. We've already got down to the oxides. And we will probably sell those oxides to a nearby plant. Our own plant is ready. We finished the tailings dams last week. We connected to the external power. We put in place a bigger crusher. And we've got a ball mill that we're going to put in, an additional ball mill to put in as well. So I'm quite excited about Silver King starting off as a was a modest project, around about 3,500 tons of copper, building up to something around about the size of an open garup again, I guess. So that Breccia pipe, as you know, is a very rich pipe, and that's where we're concentrating our efforts in working out Breccia pipe for the chalcocite. At the same time, we're working on engineering, designing a ramp so that at the bottom of the pit, maybe 90 metres, by the time we've got down there, we will have a ramp down there. You can get very cheap contractors in Zambia, but we'll mine a ramp down there. Then, of course, we need two means of access and we need ventilation. So by then, we will be from the bottom of the ramp, being able to drive through and access the open pit, thereby having a means of egress, second means of egress, and also a ventilation circuit. So we have grand plans for Silver King. And as you know, our drilling didn't find the bottom of that Breccia pipe. And so you can't chase an open pit down because the stripping ratios would get to a point where they just do not work. So that's why we're going underground with the ramp to pick up from the bottom of the pit and continue, if you like, don't let's use a better word, then chase that Breccia pipe and just see how far it goes. It could widen, Kevin. And I don't know if you remember, we put that announcement out that when we really stepped back to see how deep that, to try to find out how deep that Breccia pipe was, we intersected two. I think one was at 70 and one was at 90 something meters. We accepted two very high grade areas. So what you've got at Silver King, you have got pods, slivers, call them what you like, of high grade material, which occur somewhat randomly.
No, I mean, we visited the site, myself and Phil, obviously, with the guys. And, you know, there's obviously a lot of historic workings there. And the copper and silver grades were off the charts, I think, for the old timers in terms of taking out the middle bit, if you like. So, yeah, I don't think there's any doubt. And, I mean, there's going to be some serious silver credits coming in there as well. I mean, when you say 3,500 tons starting off when it's $14,000 a ton, you know, you don't have to be slow to say that's $49 million of revenue. And that's right. without any credit for the silver.
That's right. And, you know, we got over 200 grams silver in situ. And that's some silver value. I think that not everybody realizes Silver King was the first mine in Zambia. It wasn't a copper mine, it was a silver mine.
Yeah.
So that was worked in the late 1800s. And,
yeah, and then Glencore came in and did a whole load of work, didn't they, in terms of making the potential for Silver King to be a much bigger project and an open pit, you know, that could be extended drastically into the hillsides there. But yeah.
Yeah, well, they got 50% copper and we got 50% copper. That's us and Glencore. That Breccia pipe is extremely rich. That chalcocite, you know, you even see native copper there. The pit now, as I say, we've had the fourth blast. We're getting very close to the sulfides. Then I think we should be coming out with some exciting news. And our plant is just in time to receive that material. So all going well there.
I suppose my question for the naysayers, and I suppose you're putting your head on the block a bit, is: do you anticipate that extract will have antinomy concentrate this year and copper, silver, gold concentrate from Silver King this year?
Yeah, I'm quite happy to say the answer to that is yes, because the plan's in place. As I said, for the antimony, we've got to finalise the plans. But where are we now? We're halfway through May, so it's absolutely certainly. And Silver King is already, as I've said, at its fourth blast. So I don't want to tempt fate. But a lot would have to go wrong for us not to achieve those two objectives.
Very good. Okay. Last words on going back to Kendrick. What's your thoughts on how we go from here?
Flat out. Two words. Flat out. The proof of the pudding is in the eating. Even more simplistically, what do we want as a management team? Much of the same. Achieve those two objectives. And I think with the world's focus on the next rare earth mine, sell the refinery project, because it has to be understood that the location makes it absolutely perfect for a large refinery, to encourage a third-party investor to come in and build that refinery. As I say, that could be government to government. None of that's outside my paycheck and it's outside my control. But Kendrick, flat out, much of the same as what we're looking for. I'm not looking for any miracles in tonnages. If we double that tonnage, we're definitely world-class, and we're absolutely convinced we can do that. And the consistency of grades, quite frankly, the more channel samples, grab samples, far away from where we're drilling now, coming out exactly the same gives us that confidence. So I keep saying it, and I'll say it again, much of the same as fast as we can. That's Kendrick. And then in the meantime, making sure we disseminate it to the trade, disseminate it to governments, disseminate it to companies who are much bigger than us, disseminate it to businesses who would be interested in building a refinery or co-venturing, if you like, with building Bonya. This has to be fast-tracked. You've got, if you get something like this, which has got a great position in the world and a rapidly growing position in the world, potential supply of rare earths, you can't go to sleep, Kevin. If you snooze, you lose. We all know that saying. And there's no snooze. Yeah. There's no snooze in this side of the table, I can assure you.
And you got to know when to hold them.
That's right. Yeah. You've definitely got to know when to hold them. You've got to know when to fold them. You've got to know when to walk, and you've got to know when to run. And I guess more, and what's more relevant is don't count your money while you're sitting at the table. There'll be plenty of time to count your money when the dealing's done. So,
And I mean, there is no doubt a project this size is going to attract lots of institutional size investors. And ultimately, I think going forward, that's what Kendrick's going to need. Not that you need a lot of cash now, but I think over the next few months, as the project progresses, this is definitely what you're going to be eyeing up. And I'm sure you're going to have no shortage of suitors.
That's right. We're going to need institutional investors and probably international ones as well to complement what has been a very supportive retail section. I agree, Anton.
Yeah, and they're going to want to secure the project, if you like, by their cash. And I think that ultimately is where we're headed in a project this important and this size.
Yes, and that's why we as a management team have also got to be very careful, Kevin. You don't give it away just for a couple of million, a few million dollars when you know exactly where you want to go. You can raise the money, and each placing has got to be at a much higher level than the last placing, and you never, ever raise more money than you need. But you do need that institutional support. You need it for the fact that they're going to put the shares in the top drawer and forget them. And we need international recognition as well. So international institutions will be a blessing to this company. We don't need to give it away. The value is there. I think that the discussion has demonstrated that from the geology and mining point of view, it is not rocket science. Far from it, Kevin. But from the metallurgy and processing point of view, it has to be thought out very well. So that's where the next sort of very serious scientific third-party evaluation will take place. But make no mistake, there's been work done on this project from a process and metallurgical point of view, and it does seem, again, to tick the necessary boxes, and flow sheets have been designed. But you might think this is repetitive and why are you doing it, but we're actually starting from first principles on the basis that we feel that this is metallurgy is very important, the ideal processing route is very important, what's the final product is very important. We're going to start as though the project's never even been looked at metallurgically. Clean piece of paper. You might say that's a bit costly, but you've got to get that one right, and we intend to get it right. So it's very much the same, flat out, fast as we can, but doing it professionally, not so fast as we, you know, I'm not going to sort of skip any necessary parts of the process, nor am I going to take shortcuts. We're going to do it professionally and fast.
Very good.
Hi, Colin.
Hello there. How are you?
Not too shabby. Colin, what's the potential here? Do you know? We can compare this to other Tier 1 assets across the world, but just how high could this thing go?
Well, as Kevin said, we covered a lot of this earlier, but to answer your question, that even in the space of 2 to 3 months, we made at the outset, we said that we thought it was in the top 3, 4, 5 of undeveloped projects in the world. I think just in a few months, we've got our surprises too. And I would put it the way it's shaping to be one, if not the biggest emerging rare earth project in the world. The tonnage is almost as high as Mountain Pass already, and that's just what you see on surface. And we haven't touched both the concessions. And the grades are showing themselves to be absolutely consistent. So it's moved in into the next tier, and it was the top tier when we started. So the potential is absolutely huge. And Kevin's asked me, what are we going to do with the potential? And I've said, we're going to move as fast as we can, because we're seeing what I just love to see as a mining engineer. Mm. Consistency, repeating the results, repeating similar results, going to different plugs and getting the same result, channel sample, getting the same results, and starting off with this drone survey and what have you, and ended up with 14 million tons was a wonderful start to the tonnage story. So we're going to do pretty much the same. It's shaping up in a tremendous way, and we're not going to stop the momentum. Technically, that's geology, mining, design, metallurgy, and of course making sure that the market and the trade understands exactly what we've got.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, because most of the stocks are associated with a copper related, and the joy of copper is that yes, obviously there's different types of copper deposits, but the market understands them quite easily, I think. And with rare earths, it's a little bit more complex as a general rule. So what would you say is the de-risking stage you would be most excited to see in the near future?
I wouldn't go so far as to say de-risking, because, well, yes, I would agree with you. And I've said that I think the mining is relatively simple. The geology is relatively simple. The determination of these tons and grade is relatively simple. We've got to get the metallurgy right. And so we've sent the samples off to America, and they've been in a university, very fancy, top grade equipment is being used to look at the mineralogy. We're going to start off with a clean piece of paper. We have a flow sheet, but we're not going to sort of disclose that flow sheet. Clean sheet of paper, and we're just going to ensure that all of the suppositions which were made in the past and new ones that we make lead to the best product, the optimum product, I think is a better word than best, the optimum project and the cleanest, neatest processing route. And I've been talking about refineries. It's an ideal position for a third party to co-venture with a refinery, be it a government-to-government thing or a very, very large company. Because, you know, Ludovic, deep water, 55 kilometers from the project, we could half fill, 60% fill, 70% fill any refinery, and it's parked there to receive other rare earths from around Africa, smaller project. So that's the plan, and that's where we're going with Kendrick. And we're very excited with the consistency. I don't want fancy ups and downs and be reporting, you know, spike results. I want to be reporting level results. And when I see 112 meters, like we reported that we, you know, on Friday there, and when I see exactly the same, and when I see channel results coming out, all in the threes, three and a half, upper threes, lower threes, I do get excited, because consistency allows planning.
Yeah.
Erratic, all over the place, random samples basically makes life very difficult, especially.
Well, it's not going to happen.
Especially in the rare earth space.
Yeah. Well, do you reckon there's a chance, having sent that material off to the US, that that potential government institutions over there that are scouring for rare earth projects will be poking into what you have in the lab?
I have got no doubt in my mind whatsoever that we're on more radar screens than a 747 at not many of those around now at Heathrow Airport. We're on everybody's radar screen.
Yeah. I think you know, wishing you all the best, and I'm sure Kevin's asked all the technical questions. And it does seem to be now that maybe not the phrase wait and see, But actually, you've hit, you know, potentially the jackpot, and you know, using that phrase is, you know, a bit risky. And it's just a case of proving it all up, and every RNS you send out that proves it up more confirms the thesis. That's what we're waiting for.
I've said to Kevin, that's our plan. But basically, work as fast as we can, as professionally as we can, with the hope that we produce much of the same in terms, and the tonnage increases, the grade stays the same. And concurrently, we'll be designing the optimum processing route.
Okay, guys, I know Colin's got to go, and his good lady wife will be telling him to get his butt out there, because they've got to get on a plane. So we'll let you go, Colin, and thank you very much for your time and all the update on Kendrick, on Bazant, on African Pioneer, and on Extract. And hopefully shareholders and non-shareholders alike will be following those stories, because I think you've got potential great upside in all of those companies. So good luck.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you for coming on later, Charles, always good to talk to you. Always good to talk to you, Kevin. Indeed. And upwards and onwards. I think we've got a very exciting project, and it's for this management team to get the best out of it to the benefit of everybody.
Indeed. Thanks, Colin.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Kevin.
Thanks, Colin. Okay, so let's just have a roundup of the week. First thoughts on Kendrick. Just obviously just give us feedback on what you think. Obviously, you've asked Colin a few questions. What's your thoughts?
Well, I think it's, the share price return has been pleasant, to say the least. I mean, what are we up from since January, when I published that first piece, we were up, 20, 30x or whatever it is. So, you know, happy, happy days. But I think the question is now, you know, is this going to potentially be a tier one deposit? Do you know? The tonnage is there. The grade seems to be there. The question then is of metallurgy, but Colin seems very confident that it'll be processable. So, I think the only way still is upwards. You know, with the caveat, two caveats there. The first is obviously it is a risk play. There are risks, you know, geological risks that you got to be careful with. And the second is obviously if you were or you did happen to be in, you know, in kind of mid-early January, as we were, there's no shame taking a little profit off the table on the way up. Everybody will, you know, leave something for the next man. But I think it could go, you know, bananas. But it's really hard to say. The problem is it's hard to say what the potential is without sounding incredibly rampy. It's probably the fairest thing.
Well, my feeling on the thing is that I think for this type of project, based on the stuff that you did the comparisons with, to say that this project over the next few weeks and months was valued at £100 million is by no means blowing it out of the equation. You've got Pensana worth £350 million, and I don't think the grades are anywhere near what we're talking about here. Maybe they've got a bit more resource. I don't know in terms of the comparison. You've got Makango. What's Makango worth?
Makango, yeah, but you can't really compare that because that's more of the recycling story rather than some way.
Okay. So, but
the for example, you can compare critical metals, for example, in Greenland. You could compare Lynas rare earths in Australia. And those.
And what are they worth roughly?
Well, you know, at the peaks, you billions. It's ridiculous, and it's the problem is it's the same. It's not exactly the same, but do you remember when Greatland Gold, now Resources, hit those monster holes at the very start, right?
It eventually
went up to what 70-71x at its peak.
Yeah, obviously, I never invested at the beginning, even though I thought, it might take a bit of that, and I never did.
Yeah, well, you know, I didn't have much, comparatively much money at the time, so you know. I enjoyed a little bit of the rise, and I watched from the sidelines as it went up and up and up and up, and sort of like just kick yourself every time. But then at the same time, you know, you made a profit, be happy with that. But I think you know the lesson that I've learned over the from the markets is that you know some of the picks you're going to pick are going to lose, but others, you know, Guardian Metal Resources, for example, Delta Gold recently, ones that go on like massive, massive runs, you got to let the winners ride. So
What was it, it was Eurasia as well. It seems like the two big winners over the last 10 years, if you like, Eurasia, GGP, you got to put Greatland Gold in there as well, you know, and now Kendrick is making a go for that. You know, it's up more than 30 times, you know, 33, 34 times since the lows of 0.25. And I think it was lower than that, but let's take 0.25 as January. Yeah, amazing. Right, what else has been happening in the world of finance?
In the world, on the macro side, I don't know. Well, you have the Trump delegation off to China with all of the tech stars in the plane. So we shall see, you know, what that yields. But basically, you know, the critical minerals war is being fought because of US restricting access to semiconductors to China. So, you know, any movement there, and that will affect our market pretty strongly, but we shall see. On the micro side, United Oil and Gas putting out some very positive noises, meeting some very important people. So we'll cross our fingers and hope for an earning there. Rome Resources, I think, is looking pretty strong. I think we're looking at a buyout or at least asset sales in that company. It just everything seems to point to it from the bonus options that the management awarded themselves all the way through to surveys being done. Alfman is right there. It just seems to make sense. European Green Transition has some good news as well, boosted up their stake in one of their sub-companies. And I think European Green is just going to go from strength to strength. Capital knows how to make money. And
yeah, that was a gift of a deal as well, wasn't it? £40,000 for 28% of the company, I think it was.
Yeah, which so, is, you know, like we could probably scrap that together ourselves. So it is blue sky potential there, and obviously it is kind of very startup-y, that aspect of the business. But then that's you know, this is what where you make the money in the small caps, is the windmills. They're kind of bread and butter side of things will make all the money and generate maybe a small dividend, and then the blue sky potential for the more kind of techie stuff, that's where it could go bananas. But yeah, happy days for European Green. Amaroq had results out, everything on track. I think second half of this year it's going to re-rate to £2 a share by Christmas. Fingers crossed.
Bold prediction.
You know, not financial advice, of course. But basically, it's all on track and has been for a long time. So as long as they don't mess up the execution at you know the last hurdle of the race, we're good to go. Serval Resources, probably worth a mention. They had a decent RNS out today. Yeah, so they had the result from the geophysical surveys on a couple of their lattices in the Kalahari Copper Belt in Botswana, and they identified a few structures. Including an anticlinal structure of companies going to focus future exploration efforts. I think Serval's going to do extremely well. The licenses that they have are really, really strong, and it's just a matter of time before we go drilling and we find the copper we're looking for. Again, you know, the thing is, there's so many. I think this is the thing, like, we're kind of spoiled for choice. There's so many companies doing so well. Great Western Mining, been on a great run. The assets that they have, obviously, is close to GMET. But I think just in terms of the videos that they're putting out, the technical due diligence being done, the site visits, the fact that, you know, the CEO, Ed Loy, is a you know, respected, competent geologist, and the circles he's mixing in currently, but also in the very near future, it's you know, potentially going to go on a tear. They're fully funded. They're drilling this year. And I think like all stories, like it's an early stage story, but it depends when the assays come back. Hopefully they'll come back strong and away we go.
And it's pretty much gone on. It's pretty much gone on it already. I mean, it's up 400-500% already. I mean, maybe that isn't a big deal in terms of its market cap, but from what I was looking at, it was like, okay, it's in. That was one of those that when you tipped it, I went in and I bought some at 1.8, and decided that 3p had 12 grand's worth of profit, I think it was, and I thought, thank you very much.
Not and now it's a beer. Five.
And now it's 5.48. Yeah, so I left 20 grand for the next month by the looks of things.
I think the thing is, right, it's with all these, and I think it will just keep going higher. I really do. And obviously there's risks there, and it's exploratory and it's earlier stage than Guardian, much earlier stage, you know. So, you know, all of those caveats, I do think that they have something good. But, you know, it as
okay, so here's my comment to you, right?
Go on then, mate, hit me.
GWMO is only a couple of million pounds less valuation than Kendrick Resources is right now. Where would you put your money?
Well, it's no, nah, you can laugh, but it's
I'll no, but. I think that puts the value of Kendrick in perspective, okay?
It does. GWMO. It does. But you can say that they're both undervalued quite happily, but that Kendrick.
Yes, I'm not suggesting that GWMO is overvalued.
I'll tell you what it is, right? I think it's that, and maybe I should have asked Colin this for the question, but I didn't, you know, to be honest, I haven't had my coffee yet. But with Kendrick, because it's a rare earth deposit, you need, like, when they get independent validation, whether that's, you know, from a US state agency or from, you know, somebody else coming to site, poking holes in the ground and looking, etc., that's when it will re-rate really, really hard. And with the tungsten asset, it's just the fact that it's in the US, and the US is desperate for domestic tungsten. It's they're difficult companies to compare. It's basically it.
Okay, yeah, no, I agree with you, difficult companies to compare, but I'm just, I suppose, in the quantum of how much money we're talking about here, I'm giving a comparison of a you know, a company that has nowhere near what we see in this rare earth side of things from Kendrick, you know, at a comparable valuation is puts a perspective. The thing is that everyone thinks Kendrick is worth a fortune because it's come from £700,000 valuation after getting this asset. So, you know, the returns have been monumental. But the reality is that from this point, the returns could also be monumental. And, you know, I think people need to grasp that. But,
I just think it's just the basics, right? If a stock has appreciated 30x in the space of a few months, and then another one has gone up 3 or 4x, even if they have similar market valuations and completely different assets, the one that's gone up 30x, people just can't believe it can go high. But if you look on like the US side of things and look at the tech stocks, and particularly the valuations of startups, for example, you know, like we have, you know, positions in several kind of UK AI startups, and the speed at which these things can grow in valuation, I think maybe, you know, resource investors in particular, kind of, you know, that the sort of the multi burger exists, you just don't think it will happen to you because it's like scratching off a scratch card and winning £1 million.
Absolutely, indeed. Okay, so we're also entering into the last weeks of the season. We've got the Europa League Cup coming up with Aston Villa. We've got Liverpool playing Aston Villa on Friday night, which will have happened after you've watched this. And then the FA Cup, I think, is this weekend. Manchester City against Chelsea. So any predictions, Charles?
I bet 1-1 draw.
It'll have to go to penalties. Somebody's got to win, mate. It's the FA Cup.
No, not acceptable, I'm afraid. Fine. penalties. Manchester wins on penalties.
Man City on penalties. Mm-hmm. I think Man City in normal time, about 3-0. And then we've got all the big games then on Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. Manchester City have got to play. Arsenal have got to play on Monday. Manchester City got to play Bournemouth, which is a huge game for them. Also a huge game for Liverpool. Huge game for Aston Villa to see who plays in the Champions League. And then next Sunday, last day of the season. And then just when you thought it was all over, World Cup's a few weeks around the corner then after that, after the European or Champions League as well. So we've got a very, very busy schedule coming up in the old football world. I'm not that excited about the World Cup, I have to say.
Well,
even though I'm in America and or Hawaii, it's not very exciting.
No, I it's too, the thing is football's, you know, is designed to make money, right? But there's a balance to be had, and I think fans, there comes a point you don't want to be extracted. You feel like you're being squeezed like a lemon, you know, in this World Cup. And I think some people will obviously still go, but a lot of people, they've decided, you know, this enough. We're not playing this.
Tens of thousands of dollars to go and see any of the matches, I think, for England. By the time you've travelled, accommodation, the tickets, you know, you are talking about, you know, but you also have to have plenty of money.
I mean, the other thing is, you know, like I've been with you, you know, the US a lot, but you're kind of, there's a lot of people that don't want to travel to the US right now as well, you know, simple as that. And if it was in a European country, it'd probably be a lot more popular, but such is life.
Yeah. Who wants to see soccer anyway? We want to see football.
Indeed.
Anyway, thanks for your time, Charles. Our guest today, Colin Bird from Kendrick and various other companies, and Paul Welsh from Buccaneer Energy, which the cash flows now look like they're really starting to pile in. So take a look at that one, and we'll see you soon. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.